Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like an anti-hero.
Oh, why not the hero?
Well, I got inspired by this idea of the anti-hero because of today's guest. And I'm not talking about the latest pop song by Taylor Swift, which is also a kind of earworm that since I've been in New York, I can't get out of my head. But actually, music does inform today's guest in a different way. Definitely not Taylor Swift, I think. But he is a painter originally from Scotland, and he described the domestic as a sort of anti-heroic subject. And I was really taken by that kind of idea. He was talking about the kind of heroicism of everyday life and James Joyce. And the reason I also reference James Joyce is because books and writing and novels and storytelling is a huge part of today's guest work. Mm. And he makes paintings actually often on book covers as well. So for those who don't know his work, you must seek out that body of work, like that particular series, because he doesn't always paint on book covers. But the ones that he does are just like, I don't know, you and I love them, don't we?
Yeah.
They're super special.
There's a history to them already before the actual painting has been placed.
Yeah, exactly. So we are very excited. There's currently an exhibition on at the Hepworth Wakefield. It's called What Made You Stop Here? And we'll talk about that turn of phrase as well, because I love that turn of phrase. And it's running for ages. So it's running until the 2nd of June, 2024. Everyone travel there because I love the museum, but this exhibition is just transcendent and luminescent and all those wonderful words. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Andrew Cranston. Hi, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
How are you doing?
Good, yeah. Yeah, good. It's quite freezing here, actually, but it's, yeah.
Where is here?
Glasgow.
You're from Scotland, but you're not from Glasgow.
No, I'm from the south of Scotland, the kind of area known as the Borders, in a town called Hoyk. Yeah, I grew up there. And it's a very important place to me. It still figures large in my imagination, and it formed me in a way. But I've not lived there since I was 20.
How long does it take to get to Hoyk from where you are now then?
It's really hellish to get to, because the beach and train cuts in the 60s hit that area really bad. So there's no trains. You know, you can only go by road. Well, there's a wee train now. There's a train now that goes some of the way. Yeah, it's terrible. 2 hours on a bus from Edinburgh.
I heard you describe it as a kind of geographical exile, like the fact you hadn't been there or lived there for 30 years, but it still kind of sits within your mind, especially when you're making work, maybe.
I mean, essentially, you mentioned like James Joyce, you know, a writer like him, you know, wrote about Dublin almost always in exile. And I think there's some area your brain is recording things from the start or very early on, and you know, they can be really useful or they can just come back to you in a surprising way. I mean, I heard Nick Cave actually talking once about how when he would write a song about and it had a river or a tree in it, for him it was a very specific tree and a specific river to the small town he was from. And it's a bit like that. I think there's sort of very, you know, definite models that I have. It was a great town to grow up in. It was quite smallish, but quite busy and bustling, kind of industrial town in a way, surrounded by beautiful landscape, beautiful countryside. You should go.
It sounds great. Are there motifs from Howick then that feature in your work now? Like you're saying about Nick Cave mentioned about a tree or a river, and they're like really embedded in his kind of psyche of somewhere he places them. Is there things like moving water or objects or anything that you kind of are in your mind's eye from your past?
Yeah, I mean, I think I know the area so well, you know, just through kind of inhabiting it for those years at the beginning, you know, it would just, so there's so many things like certain landscapes, certain woods or lochs. It kind of comes up in all sorts of ways. I mean, it was quite an industrial town. It was knitwear industry, which eventually just collapsed. Well, I think kind of through Thatcher's anti-manufacturing policies, but it was quite industrial. So you'd get the kind of, almost every other street had a factory in it, and belching out steam and smoke and kind of Lowry-like, you know, in a way. So there's specific places and motifs, yes. There's loads of ways in which it keeps influencing me. And although there was no art in my family, you know, in terms of people calling themselves artists, there was great storytellers, great interested in history and talkers, you know, kind of thing. So I think storytelling's like a great art form that doesn't get called an art form. You know, it's kind of, everybody does it, even if it's the form of a joke or something, you know, people deliver this kind of story in a kind of interesting way. And I think, you know, my mum and dad were very much like that, and all my family. So yeah.
I'm from Essex, and my parents are great storytellers, and we hear the same stories over and over again, and we love them because we know the ending already. But it's like this whole, it is a real art form. But then I will write about Essex because it's in me, like elements of it, like this school bus stop outside my high school. It's embedded in my brain, and every time if it ever comes up in something, that is the bus stop. And I love this idea of making art when you're exiled from an area, but you're still drawn back to that. It's really fascinating to me.
I mean, yeah, and it's funny, I sort of, as you know, I write about the work as well. And I like misremembering things in a way. Like, you know, I think that's a creative thing to do, is that your memory's not always reliable or trustworthy, or, you know, you're maybe exaggerating or changing elements, even if you don't think you are. So I think there's a creativity in remembering itself, like you're translating something into now. You know, it's kind of a way in which all the past is there. You're in the studio and you're kind of all the past time and all the potential future times there at the same time. It's a way of time traveling, I think. You know, it's a way of sort of, you know, conjuring something up.
Making art is time traveling.
Yeah. I think that had a big impact on me growing up, certain TV kind of programs, but Dennis Potter's plays, things like Blue Remembered Hills and The Singing Detective, and the way he accessed his past as a sort of, you know, often like in, it would be in parallel with a different present, you know, so that you'd go to this childhood that he'd had in the Forest of Dean. And you got to kind of almost sort of know it through consistency in his work, you know, this place that was somehow in the background of whatever character that was there, you know. And there was something very recognisable about his childhood on screen with mine as well. You know, it was that kind of farms and wide open spaces combined with this kind of small industrial town. I mean, for him, it was coal mining, but yeah.
There's this story that I've heard of yours where, you know, you just talked about art not being something that you were really able to claim as something that you could have, or you didn't really know any artists. But then when you were 17, you were in the Lake District and you saw this, like these rocks in this river, and you were compelled to take photographs and you couldn't find a camera anywhere. So that's when you went and bought a pad and pencil and started drawing them. And then from that moment onwards, it triggered you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally true. I'd forever I mean, I had drawn a lot as a boy, and it was probably the only thing at school that, certainly primary school, that I seemed to be, I don't know, I was in the top two or three people in class, you know, was kind of sort of, was told I was good at it. But I did, you know, comics and things like that. So I had always kind of drawn a bit. But by that stage, seeing these rocks that day, I probably hadn't drawn for a few years. So it seemed like it'd come out of the blue. And I'm sure I've got the sketchbook somewhere, but terrible.
Yeah, because you don't throw anything away, right?
Well, I mean, that's maybe slightly misleading. I do. But I could do with some big bonfires.
No, don't. That sounds horrific. Don't do that.
I mean, I've seen pictures of your studio and it looks very rich with layers of numerous different influences, including loads of books, but also just lots of canvases, because I saw that you work on like numerous works at a time. It's almost like this kind of chaos, which is also not chaos because it's kind of liberating.
Yeah, sometimes you said you work on like 30 paintings at once.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
How did that start?
Well, one of the ways in which I became really conscious of it was I worked in Aberdeen for a long time. I taught up there, but I was living in Glasgow. So I was up there, you know, sometimes 2 or 3, 4 days a week, usually just 2 days a week for the last few years. And I had a studio up there and I had a studio in Glasgow. And I would kind of go between the two bodies of work, you know, so I would make these paintings in Aberdeen, get so far with them, and then I'd come back to Glasgow and have another set of paintings kind of waiting for me. So each week had these kind of little deadlines almost. And I saw it was sort of really starting to work for me, that rather than continuing on one painting or maybe a couple of paintings, to actually really sort of do more all at once. And it was something about making decisions about, you know, deciding what to do next. By not doing anything, sometimes something works out in your unconscious. Something tells you what to do next. And I think only in time does it, you know, like the sheer sort of aspect of just waiting in a way. So I found that I was much better just working on more than one, and just never really sort of even thinking of finishing them somehow. I just sort of kept moving them along. A bit like a garden, I suppose, where you've got lots of plants on the go.
Does it take the anxiety out then of focusing on one work and panicking? Suddenly you think, oh, it doesn't matter, I've got this one I can think about now.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's nothing, making a masterpiece is such a burden. You know, if you have anything like that in your head, I'm going to make a masterpiece. It's a disaster, really, kind of thing, for me anyway. And you're right, the pressure is taken away. You know, that I think also the sort of idea that you can spread your ideas across things. I think for a long time, I was trying to put everything all into one painting, everything I knew, or everything I was kind of sort of important to me or thinking about. And I think to divide the ideas in a way, to sort of, you know, think of different paintings dealing with different issues or pictorial kind of things, So it really helped me that, you know, I can just have very slight paintings that are, you know, just very light and very, you know, hardly, and then other paintings are very heavily worked. I don't need to be one thing.
Do you like your own work?
Well, I don't have any up in the house. We don't have hardly any art. I mean, Lorna, my partner, we probably just need a rest from it.
Because she's an artist as well, your partner?
She's an artist, yeah. Right, she's okay. A painter. And our studios are next door to each other as well. So
really?
So,
what's her name?
Lorna Robertson. And we met in Glasgow 26 years ago in a studio. And she liked working late and I did too. So we found we were often leaving at the same time. She lived across the other side of Glasgow. And where the studio was, I don't know if you know the Barrowlands Concert Hall.
Oh, yeah, I do, yeah.
Well, it's just right opposite across the road from that. So it's a pretty rough area, Glasgow, you know, and you necessarily want to be walking there 2 a.m. every night. So we found ourselves walking across the city every night and we got together. So, yeah, we've been sort of, you know, partners in crime, really, in painting. And so we're next door. So we show each other work all the time kind of thing. What was the question?
So you were talking about not having no art in the house, and I asked you if you liked your own work.
I feel in a kind of way it's not for me. You know, it's like I make it, and I'm often asked, you know, is it really hard, you know, giving them away or, you know, getting them taken away? No, I'm quite glad to see the back of them, to be honest, you know. And then I feel, you know, because I think being an artist, and I think especially maybe a painter, you can feel a bit mad and you do it alone, really. And it's an absurd existence, you know, a lot of the time. You know, you're in this room moving this coloured mud around and you're trying to kind of make something out of it that might be meaningful or feel significant. And then so many times it just seems, you know, like here I am, I'm 54, what am I doing? You know, like, and it can seem self-indulgent. But when the work goes out there, it then sort of, you know, takes part. It has a different life in a way. It has its own life. And I really enjoy, especially in the last few years, really enjoyed seeing what happens to the work and how other people, you know, get what they take from it and what they bring to it. You know, so I think maybe that's something I imagine a writer must experience as well.
Yes.
You know, you make this thing in a kind of quite isolation that maybe only a few people are seeing. And then it goes out there and it has a dialogue with other people, you know, but in the making, it's quite, and there's not much conversation really.
It's interesting that though, because I think a lot of successful books or art or music, it's often made with a lot of heart and kind of authenticity in a way, but it also does leave room for a viewer or a listener to actually project into it and it becomes theirs. And I've read you talk about that quite a lot, this idea of like taking things out of your paintings. So luckily, because you make so many at once, you're able to actually like almost hide things you might have put in them or strip away. And I was really into that as an idea, this idea of almost like you paint, but then you also remove things in order to allow a viewer to project a bit like you did in your childhood in theatre or the written word or what have you.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that's the space for the viewer. I mean, it's a thing that, I mean, I'm not naturally kind of minimalist. Well, you know, less is more approach. You know, I don't come from that kind of tradition or something, if you like. But there is so much in it, in the sense that I think there's a gap to be left where people can, they have to work a bit themselves to finish the image or the idea. And you can go too far with paintings. So it's sometimes a case of working backwards and kind of getting to the point where, I mean, you didn't describe things so much, or things were simpler, you know.
But that must just take time. That must just be practice to give yourself permission to be less is more.
Yes, exactly. I think it's hard to be, I think in a way, it might be a kind of thing that you come to over time.
Yes.
I don't know if it's, I'm sure people could prove me wrong with this, but it's maybe sort of harder to be simpler when you're younger.
Yes.
In a way.
I agree with all creativity. I mean, I'm an actor, and I feel like as I've got older, I'm braver. It feels braver to do nothing than to do too much. And yes. I really try and, I mean, my face is so rubbery, I frustrate myself, but I really try and do as little as possible and try and tell the story using as less like face language as possible. But my face just goes like Jim Carrey in The Mask, whatever I do. But it's it's definitely that thing of just like reducing and making it the essence of whatever it is that you're trying, the story you're trying to tell, is kind of an act of bravery in some ways.
It's also easier though for the viewer to like enjoy it then. Because I think if someone's trying too hard, it's almost like they fill so much space up that you can't even access it. And then it puts people off. So I think that's also why often people get more successful later in life.
That's interesting,
Because there's more like maturity and reduction, actually.
Yeah. I mean, the one advantage seems to be that, like, you in the course of time, you reinvented yourself a few times and you can sort of, tried so many different things out, and you know, and kind of in a way failed, you know, like more privately maybe, but failed, you know, there's all sorts of dead ends that you've been down as well. So when it's not like you get any more sure, but you do get, there's a certain maybe confidence about trusting something. There is enough, you know, you think that's I've done enough there, you know, and or that's interesting, you know, whereas I think I wouldn't have been able to accept that at some point.
Well, I think about your early works, you said about reinventing yourself. Like there was a work in 2009, I think it was you in your studio, but exploring claustrophobia, because you yourself are claustrophobic, and the earlier works were exploring this notion of being trapped in a studio, being trapped in a small confined space, almost Bacon-esque in its sort of landscape.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I think, you know, all your things are available there for exploring, fears, phobias, everything, you know, is sort of useful or rich in a kind of way. I mean, I think that there's always that confusion, isn't there, where people think you make art about things you like, you know, in a way. That there's a sort of, you know, and I think in our culture broadly, this idea of just liking something and kind of is so blunt in a way, because there's so much to be gotten out of things that you have complex feelings about. In a way, or you know, you're not sure what you think, in a kind of way. So, yeah, things like claustrophobia or something, kind of certain spaces, and they gave me a lot of food, you know, for a while. So,
do you think of an audience? We're talking about what people take from the paintings, but I've read that in some ways you don't consider an audience. The only audience you consider is other painters.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's other painters really that you imagine might be looking at them, if anybody at all. I mean, generally, nobody. You know, I don't really find it helpful to sort of think of an audience. There's only been a few occasions where I've made work very specifically for an exhibition. Normally, It's like the exhibition is just a kind of cutoff point where, you know, these are the paintings that are ready at that time or you know, but I'm very rarely of a sort of grouped work into kind of some theme or something that you think, oh, right, this is definitely for this. I mean, there was a painting in I did a show in Edinburgh in the summer, and which the work, a lot of the work has travelled to the Hepworth. Mm. And there was one painting in that which I did very specifically for an Edinburgh audience. Yeah, that's unusual.
What do you mean an Edinburgh audience? And what would that audience be that would specifically make a painting for?
It was a painting of fish in a tiled pond. It really was based on a memory of the museum in Edinburgh, the Scottish National Museum, or people in Edinburgh called it the Chamber Street Museum, used to have these fish in a pond in the foyer of the museum, and big kind of carp, you know, koi carp fish and goldfish, and they would just silently glide around, and they were right there, you know. And anybody of a certain, I mean, they didn't, when the museum got a facelift in, I think, about 20 years ago, they did away with the fish.
Oh, where did the fish go?
Glasgow.
Oh, they got moved. They weren't made into fish and chips or anything. They went off. Okay,
they got moved to the Kibble Palace in Glasgow.
Oh, nice.
Now I can see them all the time. But it was an incredible sort of beautiful sight, really, these fish. And so many, I posted a image of this fish because I'd worked with this image a few times. And I was really struck by the amount of people from Edinburgh that instantly knew what I was referring to. And it was part of their childhood. And it was like a real sort of feature, like a kind of motif in Edinburgh. So I kind of was doing this show in Edinburgh, and I just had tried a few times to make a bigger version of that, the image, and always sort of failed somehow. It just never worked. I never got the scale right. Surface was never right. So there are things I chuck in the bucket, by the way. But this time I just saw how to do it. So and I kind of had a clearer idea, you know, how to make it. But, you know, really I don't make work for exhibitions. And the audience is, I have to forget it somehow. It can be such a distraction.
But when your audience is are the painters, then what does that drive you? Does that drive you to be better? Does that drive you because you know you're going to have your peers like critiquing the work?
Like big skills.
Having that as an audience in your mind's eye, that must really make you work harder in the studio.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's kind of, I can't slack off. I don't know.
Are there certain artists in your head that you can see in front of your paintings going, oh, I'm not sure of this one, Andrew? Or are there, like, do you see like Peter Doig, obviously, is a friend of yours? Do you consider him looking at a painting and going, not your best, or this is great?
Yeah, he's there. lots of London painters, Paul Housley, somebody, Dave Martin, you know, there's quite a few that I think, oh, they'll see this, you know.
It's quite nightmarish, like a Greek chorus of artists all sort of just hanging over your shoulders every time you make a painting.
God, that would make a great scene in a film or something.
Yeah. I don't know, you know, people I worked beside in Aberdeen, they're all over, you know, like, this is interesting, but Instagram is sort of like a genuine global village now. Of people you're connected with, you know, in a way. It's interesting. I mean, do you find that if you're acting, you look down and if you were in a play and you'd see another actor there, would that be?
I think. I think you consider your peers. Yeah, you sort of want the approval or the attention of your industry, don't you? I guess that's the biggest accolade. If you're, you know, like if you're an artist, that's kind of the highest accolade you can have, really, isn't it?
We also have our group chat, Russ, where we all analyze each other's, not my performances, but the other people are in it are all actors. So every time they're on TV, we all do little reviews. You said with Glee earlier on, Andrew, about the fish coming to Glasgow and that you're able to go see them. What do you like going to see, like, other people's work or older art? Because I know every time I've read about your work, it mentions like Vriard, or it mentions, I don't
Mirandi
know,
Milne or
Mirandi. And actually that's a really great example of reduction in a way of like stripping things back to their core essence, almost, in the object. But what sort of things bring you joy or inspiration and, you know, set you alight?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's a museum very near me, Kelvin Grove Art Gallery. There's things in there that I really love, you know. In fact, there's a couple of Vuillard's paintings in there.
Mm.
There's a lovely Picasso, you know. But funnily enough, I mean, Glasgow's not great for collections, really. So, you know, art's in a way slightly elsewhere, really. It's not the same thing, but I get a lot from reproduction. I get a lot from postcards and books and, you know, and then, you know, we may go to London or Paris or New York and see the real things. I mean, there's a room in New York in Matisse's, which that room is just perfection in a kind of way. It's I could just, you know, that film Stalker, Tarkovsky film Stalker, where the room is a kind of mythic room that all your dreams come true. That's the Matisse room in MoMA. That's kind of perfection.
Which works are they by him there? I'm trying to remember if I've seen them.
Red Studios. Red Studio. Yeah.
Did you see the exhibition at the Red Studio that was up recently? It was the most incredible, like, curation.
With the objects and all the paintings and it within the paintings.
Yeah, because you've got the Red Studio, so it's all objects in his studio. And you walked into curation, I was a bit like, I don't really understand what's going on here. Then suddenly you realise that all the objects that are in the painting, the actual physical object is suddenly on the wall next to you, or it's the sculpture. And everything that he'd painted had come to life in that room. It was the most incredible curation. It was phenomenal.
Yeah, I saw that show. It was just wonderful. There's the piano lesson in there. Mm. I mean, just every work is just incredible. And they're, you know, I think, you know, Matisse is kind of misunderstood in a sort of way. You know, he's kind of thought of in some ways as a quite, you know, pretty painter, or somebody that's just sort of quite bourgeois. But the decisions he makes in paintings are so brave and raw. There's a real rawness to his work, which still seems really very alive 100 years later, and quite direct in a way. And yet there's a kind of weight to them as well, even though they've no flippancy to them. Yeah, I just absorb things all the time. That's what I'm constantly doing.
You've described that as the hunt before, of trying to find the next painting, but through the daily, like, everyday experience. You don't push yourself, like you've described having like quite a routine existence. So it's not like you push yourself outside of your comfort zone to get inspiration. You're always mining the mundane, I guess, but you find that. What I'd basically like to talk about is something that I read that you've coined is daily cosmic shock, which I think is such an amazing term. What, can you talk about that and how that comes into your practice?
I mean, I'm not at all religious in any kind of way. I've never had a moment's kind of feeling or anything like that. But I do think there is that sort of shock every day, really, that there's anything here at all, you know, that there's something rather than nothing. And I mean, I experienced it on waking up, but also just, you know, dozens or hundreds of times a day, really, where, you know, this is all going on, and you can kind of frighten yourself almost by sort of a level of consciousness where it's it appears to be real. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a awareness really that which, if you can kind of grasp it, seems extremely profound. I mean, you know, I taught when I was teaching, I taught a lot of life drawing, I taught a lot of life painting and life drawing. And this was in Aberdeen, which is, you know, Scotland's got a slightly different system from England, and lots of the changes that were made in English art schools, like in the 1960s and 70s, didn't really happen in Scotland. So life drawing has just continued throughout that time. And I did a lot, I taught a lot of life drawing. And I think, you know, from the outside, it could seem like it's a quite arcane exercise in trying to represent, you know, a naked figure or something like that. But what I think was really going on was you were trying to instill an awareness of differences and similarities. And the model often just provided a focus for that, something to look at. It could have been a chair, or it could have been, you know, anything really. But it's the process of a kind of awareness and attention to things, which I think is what is going on often when you're in a life room, you know. And I think it to me is quite a profound thing, and quite, I mean, you know, we'd maybe get students drawing for 5 or 6 hours. You know, to be in a room in silence for 5 and 6 hours, looking at the same thing, that just does you such enormous good, even if the drawings don't look like, you know, it's almost like the drawing is just a byproduct of that experience and that process. You know,
I think I find that experience profound in the fact that people are looking at the same subject for that long, but yet, like a fingerprint, everybody's drawing will be completely different. We're all so unique when it comes to our artistic abilities, but yet we're all looking at exactly the same thing.
Yeah, and also how each person interprets something, or how they see, because no one person does actually see the same.
No, that's right. And I think even, and you're looking, I think, requires so much testing, you know, of things, you know, that you know, there's a sort of, often you think you know what something looks like, and you're fighting with a kind of existing image of the thing already. And then actually when you look at it, it's quite different.
Yeah, you take things for granted. And then if you really look at it, you go, oh, that's what that looks like. I've just seen it like peripherally. You've taken the information in. But is there a difference then for you between looking and seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose seeing is kind of looking plus understanding in a kind of way. It's like there's something about a kind of realization and seeing, you know. And I mean, seeing's maybe more loaded a word in a kind of way that you realize the truth of something. You're seeing it in a way as opposed to just looking at it. But there's so much pleasure in looking as well, kind of thing, that we just, yeah, we do take that for granted in a kind of way, that, you know, there's the sheer pleasure of colour and, you know, form. You know, it's a daily thrill. I think every situation's got something in it which is is full of potential. So I never, in a way, you know, it's interesting you talk about the hunt for images. In some ways, it's the opposite of that. You know, it is that, but it's kind of, you're always on the lookout. But in some ways, the things around you are often, they're enough. It's under your nose all the time.
I mean, some of the best writing or poetry is from that. It's from like a domestic space, and the people never even leave their towns, but they write books that last for hundreds of years. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
I've always loved that. I think that's such a gem of an.
You said you find the everyday life anything but mundane, which is kind of beautiful. Yeah. That like the magic of a average day lived is beautiful.
Yeah, it has. There's a kind of thrill of existing at all, but and you know that feeling when dust comes into a room or a shaft of sunlight illuminates the dust. You know, it's just there all along, kind of thing.
Well, but I look at that and think that's just a load of old skin that we're breathing in and out the whole day, and it's only when the sunlight comes in you go, oh my God, that's around us all the time.
Really,
but you see that opposite to me. You love it.
I'm a bit more Quentin Crisp about that.
Is painting addictive?
Oh, yes. I mean, nothing really quite like it. It is a kind of monkey on your back kind of analogy when you're never quite satisfied in a way. But I think, I find it very addictive. I think it just keeps kind of leading to the next thing, you know, so there's no end to it in a way. There's no resolution.
How do you leave the studio then? How do you, if you're working on all these paintings at once and you don't have any work at home, how do you leave these images behind if there's this constant drive to and this addiction to keep making images?
Well, I mean, in a way, mercifully, I've got children and I've I have to go home and, you know, sort of pick people up for school or feed people and things like that. But me and Lorna talk about this all the time, that, like, you know, sometimes it is very hard to leave. And in that is the absurdity. You know, you think, I could be out there having a life. You know, I could be kind of just totally enjoying myself, you know, all the time. But you're locked into this often. You have to leave. You have to. I mean, there's often a kind of slight thing you do before you leave, which is some kind of risk, something risky, or you just kind of make something to you, which you know is you're going to come back to.
Like what? Like what? What would that be?
I mean, in the more extreme things, it could be just, you know, pouring paint over something, like, and then lying it upright to, you know, the gravity to run, make the paint run down. And you know that, like, it's some things are going to have happened while you're away.
The alchemy of it. Will you take that home with you then? Will you be thinking about that the whole time then? So if you leave it or you leave an image behind, are you kind of like going over that in your head?
Yeah, totally. It's like that. And there's a great Pink Panther cartoon where the paintings all come alive at night. Sort of in the in the Louvre or something, and they're all chasing each other around. I mean, there is that sort of, thought of them really there, kind of thing. But yeah, I've always wanted things to come back to, so that, you know, you're, in a way, you might even just make a complete mess in order to have something to sort out. You know, destruction's quite important as well, to sort of feel the freedom to be able to destroy something, and having faith that sometimes in that destruction, something new's going to be there that might be better.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week.
Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A phoenix. A phoenix from the flames.
How was it in the late 90s when you became a dad and you were suddenly a parent? How did that impact your work? Because I read that it did sort of shift the way that you thought about things. Like, obviously, as it would, but I mean creatively.
Yeah, I mean, that probably is where the first time the domestic kind of entered my thoughts, you know, where, you know, I was maybe spending more time inside than I had before and started to see the possibilities of that, you know, and the kind of potential for things. And, you know, it's always complicated when, you know, painting takes a time, you know, it's quite demanding for time. So there was a shift in mentally where I had to think slightly. I had to adapt really into thinking, you know, almost pockets of time that I might only have to make the work. So it gave a greater importance to the time when I wasn't making work as to where things were gestating, and I kind of, to make that analogy. So no time was wasted, really. Of course, I mean, the experience, you know, opened up so many things, you know, emotionally. And just what was useful as well is it reminded you of things, you know, it kind of gave you a sort of quite non-verbal reminder of something that you'd almost forgot or you had forgot, but was somehow deep within you. And it was being, you know, awoken by smell and by touch and by, you know, just all the kind of things that you know, when you're having, you have babies kind of and young children that are pre-language in a kind of way. And they just exist in the visual and you know, audio, smell kind of world.
But also colour and interpretation of colour. And like, I remember when I first saw your work, I immediately weirdly thought of Helen Frankenthaler. And I've always loved her work. And then also the literary influences with you was like Emily Dickinson for me, because there's something about the way she never left home and just used to write poetry. You know, it's some of the best poetry ever written and she never left. You know what I mean? Like her house. It's just things like that. But how has colour kind of impacted your life? And I know colour plays such a big work in the paintings.
Yeah, I mean, it you know, for a long time I felt wasn't as confident with colour. You know, and it's come and gone, you know, but it was more a rediscovery. It's interesting thinking back to colour and even first sort of prejudices or feelings towards colour. Like the colour yellow is quite important to me. I don't know why, but, well, I think I know why. I think it was prevalent in our house growing up. And just a few things, just that kind of somehow my mum had yellow curtains. And
didn't it form a big landscape, though, that you had at the Royal College of Art, a big paint? Well, not College of Art, before that, you showed a big painting that was your mum in a scarf, and it was like a landscape, and that was a big yellow ground that you had across the whole thing.
Yeah, that's right. And it was kind of, in fact, it came about in a kind of most crazy way. I just found a big tin of yellow paint and and I only had tiny little colours for other paints. So I thought, this painting's going to be predominantly yellow.
And you got a positive response to it, though, right? Like that made you go, yeah. Oh, wow. And that then, well, encouraged you, but also gave a confidence in you to keep going.
Yeah, that's right. But yeah, I think colour, it has it can be a trigger for so many feelings and ideas, really, in itself, in a way. I mean, I think I've struggled sometimes. It's like I have to experience the colour in some way, you know, which I find puzzling, but it's a thing you touched on before about giving yourself permission. And sometimes there's you don't want to be a tourist with colour. That, you know, it's somehow got to be from a lived experience, if that makes sense.
I love that. You don't want to be a tourist with colour. That's great.
But you actually use specific materials as well, which sort of make the colour feel different, like way more atmospheric, mm-hmm. like in terms of distemper. And like I have a house in Margate and I painted it with lime paint. So I'm very familiar with this kind of idea of lime and the way it's much more natural, and also the chalk cliffs around here in chalk. And I know that there's loads of cave paintings and all these kind of things locally here in Kent. And it got me thinking a lot about your surface and the way that the colour is almost like a memory or something because of the distemper. And I'd never really thought much about distemper because I'd never made art, but I've been looking into it a lot, and it's a really interesting material to have chosen. How did that come about?
And what is distemper for people who don't know?
I think this is the definition of it. I mean, I think it's really just a pigment and a binder. Now, the binder, often I've used and other people have used, is rabbit skin glue, which is just a kind of animal glue that you warm up and then mix the pigment into it. But you can get artificial binders as well, which sort of, you know, make it easier. I kind of had a desire to change my work. You know, I was making very small paintings and big paintings, nothing in between. And that's generally still the case. They're either very large or not very large, but large or very small. And I kind of felt the bigger paintings weren't quite as unique or something as the small paintings, or surprising or somehow. And they were done with oil paint. I have them all still. It was a period where nobody really kind of wanted to buy anything. But I wanted to change the bigger paintings. And I reminded of a Clement Greenberg mantra.
He's a critic, wasn't he? He was an art critic.
Yeah. He said, if you want to change your work, change your method. I was thinking of other ways of making bigger paintings. And I was hankering after a kind of lightness, really, rather than a sort of big, heavy oil paintings. I wanted to explore big paintings that maybe were like watercolors sort of thing, you know, like they had the lightness of a watercolor, but they might be 7-8 feet tall. And Tal R had done a show of Victoria Miro using distemper, and Peter Doig was using it as well. And of course, I'd seen the Vuillard paintings where sometimes that was his medium, which was distemper. And you know, I just thought, I'll give it a try. So I started kind of using it, really. And it instantly just, I don't know, made me make paintings in a different way. I started to kind of much more consciously use negative space and areas between things more. I was more aware of that. And you could see how Vuillard actually, I think, arrived at the way he worked, because the tendency with that kind of painting, you know, with oil painting, you might have 30 colours all laid out, and you might be dipping into them all the time.
Mm.
You can't really do that so much with working in distemper. You tend to mix up a colour, and it invites you to use a lot of that colour, and then maybe mix another colour and use that colour. So you kind of, in a way, you're sort of making areas of the paint in certain colour. So it kind of leads to a kind of blocking in that happens, where you're blocking in bits of the paint and much, much more often. And there's a kind of flatness happens. So it did do what I was hoping it to do. It did lead me to almost a change in the work.
But there's also a direct, like, literal link to like theatrical scenery from history, because I think in the Egyptian times it was used within homes, which obviously a lot of your work depict these domestic spaces. And I know you even think the medium of a painting is offers that kind of interior space, like paintings can be a room. But like, I found that really fascinating, like whether that was a deliberate decision or just a coincidental thing.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, one of the big kind of influence on me was visiting Italy I was maybe just early 20s, and seeing lots of frescoes and the quality of the fresco, the wall, and even the kind of decay of them, or the, you know, the deterioration of them, seemed really exciting. And as a surface, this, you meant, chalky kind of dryness, you know. So yeah, absolutely. That kind of idea of the painting as a kind of wall really is quite exciting.
It's weird as well, because in the 70s, apparently councils used to like paint council houses or council flats with that type of paint as well. I think because it was possibly more affordable or something.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting, because I was wondering whether that as an aesthetic also, you know, in your childhood, whether it also somehow echoes like a subconscious memory, like a suppressed, I don't know, because for me, having lived now, like in this kind of house with lime paint around me and stuff, because I think it's also called cement paint, like it's got all these words that are very like specific, and it's such a quality of atmosphere that I'm not, I mean, I have seen it in Doig's work, you're right, and Vuillard and other people, but it's not that regular. You don't see it all the time. Do you know what I mean? In contemporary art.
No, it's not an easy way to paint either. It's, you know, like, I wouldn't really recommend it to anybody. I mean, it's oil paint's
pain in the ass.
The reason why it kind of came about and it stuck, you know, I mean, it's interesting that you do feel a bit connected to something really ancient, I think.
Yes.
Thinking it, you know, that like in its basic sort of, the pigment is rock, you know, just quarried rock, and then you're mixing it with this glue that, you know, might be an animal glue. It's like from I think it's from the beef industry rather than, it's called rabbit skin glue, but I don't think it has anything to do with rabbits now, you know. So it you know, and you could imagine that, you know, thousands of years ago, really being the way that people were painting. So it's a kind of curious thing about, you know, trying to make contemporary painting, you know, in this very ancient way. Yeah.
There were also loads of connections to nature back then, apparently. So like, I think like here locally in Margate, a lot of the houses were painted a kind of rich green, which was to do with the sea moss, like, or the moss that grows on the chalk cliffs. And they would actually almost like go and sample somehow, or like bring the moss to the house, and then they'd mix the paints to like match to the moss color, which I just find fascinating. So there's this real like direct connection to choices of color
through nature as well, isn't it?
Through nature. I know, but I loved that. Great. And apparently the house I'm living in now breathes better because it's lime paint. So if it rains on the wall and then you get a damp patch, it will just dry out because it's all breathable. But I'm really into this idea of like the natural and the kind of connection to nature.
I mean, I remember I went on a boat trip in Bruges, and I don't know if this is true, but the guy that was doing the guided tour, he pointed out this building, and it was a kind of brown building, and he said it was painted with ox blood.
Oh, right.
It's kind of like, you know, it was a very old building. This is how it had been painted, ox blood. I don't know if he was having a song. I don't know.
No, but you know what? I think oxblood was a thing. There's an artist called Edith de Kint who's from Belgium, and she makes work with oxblood and or like blood from animals and stuff. A bit like the guy we interviewed last week, actually, but his is other kinds of blood, but or it is animal blood too. But yeah, it's definitely a thing historically and within Europe as well, within Belgium.
I like the idea of it, but I wouldn't want to live in a house that's painted with oxblood, to be honest with you. any blood. I don't want anything painted in blood, thank you. But you mentioned earlier on that there was a period in time in your career where nobody wanted to buy your work, and that is certainly not the case now. You are internationally collected. You are in incredible institutional exhibition collections. You are currently at the Hepworth. This is your first solo UK institutional show. You're a big success, Andrew. What does that feel like? And is that sort of thing that you bring into the studio with you, or do you have to forget it? What does success feel like for Andrew Cranston?
Well, I mean, I think in a kind of way, this is good. I mean, I'm really enjoying it.
Good.
Of course, needless to say, you're much more defined by all the time before, when it was kind of lonely or it was kind, you know, there wasn't that interest, you know. So I don't think it sort of changes everything and nothing somehow. Obviously it makes lots of material things easier, you know, that you don't really have to think about, which you might have had to do before. But, you know, I don't know if it helps you make a better painting or kind of more interesting painting. You're back somehow facing those big questions still. So it is a curious one. I mean, it's sometimes curious where you think, and you know, well, it's not like you could just do anything that would sell, but you know, it can be confusing, you know, where you think, well, you know, when the work wasn't really selling so much, you know, I couldn't be affected by that, because you could have exhibitions and nothing would sell, and you had to feel strong enough that, well, the work's still good.
Yeah, what kept you going then during that? How did you maintain that?
You know, some kind of blind faith or stubbornness or maybe just chime in with yourself that you think, well, this is the work I wanted to make. This is it, you know, like, and I can't be affected by that. And so, well, for a long time, most of the people that bought any work were other artists, painters, really.
Interesting.
And just really for a few hundred pounds. So
is a local art scene something that has been very important to you? Because I was about to say that, like, even if it didn't sell, you might have had really nice comments from people who saw a show, or a local gallery took you on, or you know what I mean, like things like that. Because I know you've worked with numerous galleries.
No, I mean, it's interesting with Glasgow. I have a kind of, I think, maybe a complex relationship with the art world there, not through any big choice, but Glasgow's got a great art scene, you know, in many ways. It's kind of thought of as maybe the city outside of London that is, you know, where art is a very important thing. I haven't really sort of benefited much from the art scene that's been here. I've shown a few times in places, and I was very much kind of in the artist-run scene for a long time, where you found a space and you put your work on.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no question of money at all, and that can be really useful to actually sort of take any kind of financial imperative out of it entirely. So you're making the work for some kind of more pure freedom, you know, like of expression, you know, to try and sort of maybe say something in that field that you're working in, or, you know, just, and as, yeah, get kind of some currency, is it the currency of feedback, if you like, people. So there was always, yeah, there's always people, but I think any kind of more official sort of channels, I was not on the radar at all.
Well, I feel like critique's been most really important to you. Good critique obviously encourages anyone to move forward creatively, but you know, you critique, you were saying, with your partner now, because your studio's next to each other, you have this Greek chorus of art people that are critiquing you in your mind's eye. You know, your critical reviews you had at college that made you feel like you were an artist, you could do. These things have been fundamental to your practice. And I guess for many artists, they may not realize the positives of critique, whether they are good or bad. Is that something that you would celebrate and encourage people to look for?
Yeah, I mean, it can be hard, you know, because it's hard to divorce yourself from the work always, so that any kind of criticism, you know, you have to almost separate it, that the criticism might be of the work and not of you. You know, that's a skill in itself, isn't it? To kind of not take things too kind of personally and think to yourself, well, what could make the work better in a way, or change it in some way, or you know, amplify some aspect of it. You know, I mean, it was interesting teaching, you know, and obviously I got a lot out of that experience, where I think at its best you were just having conversations with artists or art students. And it wasn't teaching in that kind of sort of didactic sense. It was kind of more trying to sort of talk around the work, or you know, deconstruct it maybe, but also think of it much more rhetorically. So, you know, you could kind of ask a question and answer it as well, but you're not. Yeah, I think that's it is useful, but I think I've not worked necessarily in a kind of community of that in Glasgow. It's been just odd individuals kind of thing, really.
Well, before we get on to our final questions, could you describe the feeling of knowing when a painting is finished?
No.
How do you know then?
Ideally, it has sat around for a while.
And you're bored of it. It's like, fuck off, yeah.
There's nothing else to add to it. It has a completeness that is tested through seeing it repeatedly and kind of constantly. And it's kind of, it settles into itself as a finished thing, you know.
What's the longest of paintings sat around in view?
I mean, probably, yeah, maybe 10 years, something like that.
That you've been looking at for 10 years, it's been there peripherally or in vision?
No, maybe that's maybe not quite like that. But there's things on the go for a long time.
Wow.
That I've kind of sort of just never got around to sort of finishing. And it can happen a lot where I make something, and as you say, the studio is quite messy. And actually, the small paintings especially, they disappear a bit. I actually physically lose sight of them under various accretions of things. And then they surface again at some point. And they often seem finished in a way that it didn't at all seem finished when I made it. It's like, you know, it's like I've caught up with something. I've caught up with the painting itself. And it seems complete.
But that's also the benefit of having so many things going on at once, because also you then don't ruin something or destroy it by overpainting it, or doing... Because I've seen friends who do that, who just like paint over the stuff too much, and then they're like, fuck, why did I do it? Like, I've ruined the painting, you have to start again.
I mean, that's it. It's nice to have lots of things to work on. And I mean, it can be a problem where, you know, somebody's got maybe two or three big canvases and, you know, it's their big canvas. And it's like they almost want value out of it to be able to work on it. You know, it's like I remember when I first saw Sophie von Hellermann's work for the first time, and it seemed so fresh. And it really, some of that freshness was just clearly through the immediacy of how it was made. You know, that it was, it looked like it was made in a kind of one go. And that's quite hard to, allow yourself that. And sometimes it doesn't happen because you think, well, this canvas has cost me like, you know, £150 to make.
Yeah.
Something, you know, kind of thing. I need my money's worth. And that's no reason really to be keeping working on something. So it's sometimes best to work on almost things that are kind of not loaded with value at the beginning. And you're kind of trying to make them valuable, you know? So it's like, you know, it could be the back of a cornflakes packet or something. But
is that why you paint on book covers then?
It came about in an accidental way. But there is something there that it's easy to find lots of books. So, yeah, they're kind of bountiful, really. I'm not thinking too much about the value of it before I start.
Less precious.
Yeah.
There's a quote here before we get into fine questions where you say, don't be too respectful of the painting. It's got to be almost in the bin all the time.
Yeah.
And I love that.
That is so good.
Talking about not being precious with it. It's got to be like any minute now, you're like, you've got to chuck that. It's just in like always teetering on the edge.
Some of them,
Yeah,
some of them do.
So our final question is, this has been amazing, Andrew. Thank you so much for sharing the stories of all your coloured mud. I love that phrase.
Joseph Beuys, apparently. That's what Joseph Beuys's description of painting was, is coloured mud on fabric. He meant it as a put down of painting. But, you know, in some ways it's like, I don't know, that's quite...
Yeah, I like that. I've written that down. Yeah. Coloured mud on fabric. So the questions we ask every guest that comes on, the first one is, if you could do an art heist, you could have any artwork in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
This is like Desert Island Discs or something.
Absolutely it is.
It's the art Desert Island Discs.
I mean, I was talking about Matisse before. It might be the Red Studio, actually.
Amazing.
A Munch is very important to me as well. One of the ones, the kind of rooms where there are people dying in them and they're kind of deathbed scenes. Yeah, I think I'll go for that. I think I'll go for Munch. I think Munch has been center of a heist before, hasn't he?
Oh, the Scream.
Yeah, many times.
One of the Screams. Yeah.
I think a few times.
I thought you were going to say Van Gogh's Sunflowers, because I think it's one of the first prints you saw, but for many years you thought it was a dog's head.
Yeah, that's true. That's one of the few things in our house. Yeah, Van Gogh, it's great.
But you thought the Sunflowers was a dog's head? Till what age did you realise it isn't? Really? I'm going to have a look at it now.
Oh my God, it's like one of those images that you look at and then it reveals an image. Maybe
well, that's
like
the looking and the seeing, isn't it?
That is.
I think as well, you probably read things at a certain age. Of course, you only have a certain reference field of reference for what it could be. I probably had never seen a sunflower, but I'd seen lots of dogs.
Right.
I don't know. The thing only matched with the experience.
But your work often includes animals, and I heard you saying that you don't actually have that you don't have pets or some sort of massive passion for animals in a kind of romantic way or something. But it's more like that they're in the work for a specific reason. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. No, the animals do turn up a lot. I mean, I like them as. Well, they're almost figurative elements, you know, in the sense that there's a sort of presence in a painting, or it's got an essence or a kind of, you know, it's alive in the painting. So they kind of maybe do something like a figure in a kind of way. And then there's what people bring to animals in a way, a kind of empathy. I mean, it's interesting, you know, like even we see on Instagram, the amount of people that, you know, their pets and cats and dogs
and
everything.
That's me and Rob, yeah. That's us, Andrew, yeah.
You know, it's a great leveler, yeah. You know, like, I mean, do you know Matthew Higgs?
Yeah, of course.
You
know,
yes.
You know, his dog's got its own page.
Beryl, isn't it? Is it Beryl?
Olive,
that's it. Sorry, yes.
My cat's window and doorway have their own page.
So it's like it cuts across everything, you know, in a kind of way. And it's often a private side of people as well, that, you know, their relationship to that that's kind of uncurated in a kind of way. I don't know. I mean, I funnily have been always returning to, do you know the book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
No.
The Philip K. Dick book, which Blade Runner is based on.
Oh, right.
Science fiction novel. Oh. The novel's quite different from the film, and animals feature quite a lot in the book. It's essentially a kind of post-nuclear world where animals have died off pretty much, and people have, well, genetic or electronic animals and stuff like this. And there's a few real animals, and it becomes the way in which people's empathy is tested, and therefore whether they are human or an android is kind of how they relate to animals. And I think there's a kind of ecological reason in there as well, sort of almost guilt that, you know, the natural world is being so put under pressure, really. But yeah, I mean, they're great to draw as well.
Right.
They're great cats and dogs and kind of, you know, great shapes. So I think the impulse is an abstract one as well as what they are.
Yeah.
You get enjoyment in the process. The other question we ask is, what is your favourite colour?
Yellow. I think I'm going to go yellow. I don't know if it's my favourite, but it is the one that intrigues me the most. You know, I can't quite get to the bottom of it in a way. It's maybe associated with illness and jaundice and sunshine, you know, Van Gogh kind of
madness.
Van Gogh, yes. Van Gogh kind of owns yellow. When I couldn't travel very far when I was a child, literally car sick after 10 miles. And the thing that almost always made me sick, but my parents had this yellow, well, I suppose you call it a kind of potty. Do you know what I mean? It was like a vessel, plastic vessel with handles. Don't know if it had. And it was a pale yellow. It was like oil paint would be like a nickel yellow. Very kind of lemon yellowy colour. As soon as I saw that yellow, violently sick. So,
oh wow,
it's a complex feeling.
But that's the colour you. That's your favourite colour, even though you were violently sick. Great.
Well, he likes to be challenged. I like that this. As well.
It's funny. They sent me a question, which I thought you were going to ask. And it was like, what is the best piece of advice you've had?
Oh, yeah, we're going to ask that now. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Well, in Manchester, in 1989, I moved from Hoyk to Manchester to do a foundation course. And I had hardly even been to a city, never mind lived in a city. So I moved to Manchester in 1989. Which was, he was having, you know, this big cultural moment with the music and stuff. I was so naive, but the course was terrific. And there was a few painters there that took many of us kind of under their wing. And this guy, Dave Pearson, he would kind of talk in riddles a little bit. But he said this thing to me that he said, get into the habit of wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whether you're in a nightclub or you're in a mountainside or you're lying in your bed ill or in any situation, ask yourself, is there a painting in this? And I think I have done that. I think I have always thought of any situation I'm in and almost been looking at it as potential subject. And it means you're never stuck because your ideas just follow the course of your life. And, you know, they come to you in a way. The ideas are just always coming to you.
That's beautiful. I also really loved it when you described your practice as, or sorry, your process as haphazard and somewhat shambolic. I thought that was such a kind of release for people listening to know the non-order, you know what I mean, can be
fruitful. You find chaos stimulating as well, I think I've heard you say.
Yeah, but it's just liberating that as an idea, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of, and you know, it's interesting, like Francis Bacon, how actually quite slick his images are sometimes. You know, the background's very flat and they don't look like they've come out of a kind of mess, actually. They look quite clinical in a kind of way. So I think there's a kind of, there's an interesting relationship between something about mess and the anarchy of just, you know, things and trying to make something, trying to get some order really from that.
Amazing. Well, I just want to finish on a quote that when we were talking about dogs, I was trying to find this quote in my phone that Ellen Jones, who's a mutual friend of mine and Rob's, she said was from her favourite radio show called Cabin Pressure from years ago. And she said that dogs are a secret loophole that allow the British to talk to strangers. And that stayed with me because I thought that was amazing. And I think that your work allows us to talk to strangers because your work is connecting with so many. And it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you now. I think we've been talking for an hour and a half nearly, Andrew, and this is just zipped along. It's been amazing.
Brilliant. Loved it all. Yeah. Thank you so much.
The exhibition at the Hepworth Wakefield, which as Rob was saying, is on till the middle of next year. What made you stop here? Which we didn't go into, but that's about, I think that's based on your parents saying, are you stopping tonight when you're going to stay at someone's house? I love that phrase.
I know, like sleeping over or staying over. Yeah.
It is that. It was also the meaning of when do you stop painting? You know, in a way, your question of when is it finished?
Yeah.
You know, I think. So I kind of thought I'd cover it. It was kind of two meanings in a kind of way. Yeah.
Amazing.
So the show runs until the 2nd of June, 2024, but you must get there now because I reckon you're going to want to see it more than once. And if you would like to learn a bit more, there's an amazing film that the Hepworth Wakefield's made, a small kind of documentary about Andrew. It's really beautiful. Really worth watching. Andrew, are you on social media?
Yeah.
What's your Instagram? Is it just Andrew Cranston?
Yeah, it is. I think cool. It's got a dot after Andrew.
Andrew.Cranston. So we will connect to you on our Instagram at Talkart and we'll be back very soon. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Andrew,
for your generosity. You're amazing. We love
Thanks.
You.
Thanks.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talkart with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talkart, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talkart at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.